Good late morning to you. We're, if I can get the panelists to quiet down, maybe we can start. You know you're in for quite a ride when the panel is having this much fun before we start. The session this afternoon, number 234, is entitled Hidden Envy and Competition Among LDS Women. It's an outgrowth of an article written by Julie Mountier Harker in Sunstone, the November issue. And you can read a little bit more about it in the abstract for the session. My name is Mary Ellen Robertson. I'll be moderating and doing a little double duty as a panelist. I'll go ahead and introduce the different speakers briefly, and then we'll get started properly. I'm a graduate of BYU and have a master's in women's studies and religion from Claremont Graduate School. In the past 6 weeks, I quit my job of 10 years as a NASA contractor, got married to a fellow Sunstoner, and I'll be moving to Texas a few days after Sunstone is over. So some big changes in my life right now. So excuse me if I'm a little scatty as a result of that. Oh, by the way, if you have cell phones and pagers, put them on vibrate or turn them off so we aren't disturbed any more than we already are. Julie Hawker lives in Morgan Hill, California, and is married and has four children. She has a bachelor's in speech communication and a master's in communication studies, and teaches at San Jose State University, classes in argumentation, critical thinking, and debate. She says her favorite thing to do is talking and eating out, and best of all, doing both simultaneously. Our next speaker will be Sonia Farnsworth. She has an MA in speech communication. She's an instructor in communication theory and writing at the University of Phoenix in Salt Lake City. And she has a Master of Arts in Speech Communication from San Jose State University with an emphasis on rhetorical analysis and propaganda studies. Becky Linford, who will be our third panelist, has a PhD in history from Georgetown and is an assistant professor in history at Marymount University. She recently moved back to Northern Virginia from Cockeysville, Maryland, where she's trying to find a job that pays more than teaching. And if you ask nicely, or even if you don't ask at all, she'll probably tell you about her recent bra fitting experience. Our final panelist will be Anne Arnold. She's a licensed marriage and family therapist with a private practice. She's a clinical supervisor at Pepperdine University Community Counseling Center in Orange County, California, and an instructor at Pepperdine and Alliant International University. She's my cousin, which is kind of how she got initially roped into this gig at Sunstone West earlier this year. She lives in San Juan Capistrano, has three terrific sons and a great husband, both of which I can vouch for, an incredible daughter-in-law, and is currently studying, is currently the gospel doctrine teacher in her ward. So, and my remarks are over in my bag, excuse me. I'm sure we all have horror stories of friendships with women gone bad. I had the experience of having a 34-year-long friendship disintegrate concurrently while I was reading Julie's article before it was published in Sunstone. And I devoured everything that she had to say on the subject because I was living it as I was reading it. My friend got upset with me when I told her things were serious with my then-boyfriend and that we were planning to get married. She responded to this by starting a new relationship of her own with her married neighbor, and when I wasn't sufficiently supportive of this new relationship of hers, after slogging through a previous relationship she'd had with a married man. She got even more angry with me, sent me a series of nasty emails, and has remained silent toward me until just a few weeks ago. As Julie posits in her article, and as she'll talk a little bit more as we get into the session, sometimes jealousy and envy cause us to act in counterintuitive ways. Rather than a friend who I had known since I was four being happy that I was getting married and you know, being excited that that was happening, she reacted in quite the opposite way. And cognitively, I understand that that was probably her way of dealing with a big change, both in my life and in our friendship, because it also entails me moving out of state. So that kind of contextualizes where I came to this subject. I would have to point out that one thing that the article didn't touch on quite as much was that envy and competition is not quite so hidden, for example, in a Mormon singles ward. I was in a ward in California where a group of women would orchestrate outings and activities to which only certain people in the ward were invited. And they maintained really tight control over which women were invited to these events. And what kind of galled me was they would talk about these private parties at church as though everyone had been welcome or had attended, which I thought was especially vile. One of the guys who was a regular at these events apparently didn't get the memo and made the mistake of inviting me to one of their parties, the first and only one I was allowed to attend. I had fun watching the dynamics among the women shift the second I walked in the door, and other than that, the appeal of these private events was vastly overblown. In another ward, a woman I'd been friendly with started getting predatory with my boyfriend at the time. I was moving back to Los Angeles to go to graduate school, and I hadn't even left Ohio yet, and she was practically crawling up his pants leg at every opportunity, and reassuring me that he wouldn't be lonely when I was gone. And it didn't help when his response was, "Well, I don't think she means anything by that." And I'm like, "You don't know." Anyhow, I don't want to just recite the horror stories. I also want to talk a little bit about how not to morph into Friendzilla. And be able to relate to each other in healthier ways. One of the things I tried really hard to do with the friend that I mentioned at the beginning was to not lash out at her no matter how much she was doing that to me. It was really, really, really hard not to, because after that long of a friendship, you know each other's soft spots. And she was aiming at all mine, and it would have been really easy to aim right back at hers. And I took time with each reply to the nasty emails to make sure that I wasn't hitting below the belt, that I wasn't saying anything I would regret later. Believe me, I sure wanted to point out where she was wrong and where she was projecting and defend myself at all the charges that she was putting on my doorstep, and instead, I tried really hard to take the high road, to keep that door open in case she wanted to work out these issues in a more constructive way, and I let her know that I was willing to take the time and the energy to mend fences if she was interested in doing that. The only overture in the past year and a half came the week before my wedding, and there was really, at that point, no time to devote, no energy to devote to any reparative work with her. And, I had kept trying to keep the dialogue going or keep the door open. And she just would never, she would either respond hatefully or not at all. So I agonized quite a bit, but ultimately decided that I could not invite her to the wedding. And I'm sure that this will be, you know, should we ever try to mend fences, this will probably be one of the things she'll never forgive me for. But I didn't feel like I could do that. Also in this situation, I didn't want to do what I had done in the past, which was apologize profusely, take all the responsibility for the problem, and essentially be a doormat. In this instance, instead, I said, hey, we've got this problem, there's this tension between us, what can we do to work this out? And, you know, since I'm not groveling to get back in her good graces like I've done in the past, it shifted how much or how little progress there was between us actually trying to work things out. I do significantly mourn the fact that she is not part of my life right now and may not be in the future. But I can say that I've done all I can to facilitate a healthy resolution to this, or at least to, you know, try to have her talk to me about this. I think one of the things that we can do to maybe relate to each other in a more healthy manner is be honest with each other and be honest with ourselves. And that might be all you at first. You might be having to make the most effort in that direction. But I think that would go a long way into getting the issues out on the table and be able to discuss them openly. And be able to talk about the things that I'm sure this friend was wrestling with. You know, I was going to move away. I was going to get married. Things were going to change between us, and that was scary for her, for me. And how are we going to still be friends, given the geographical separation? And I think if we had been able to talk on that level and just say, I'm sad. I'm happy for you, but I'm sad about these other things that come with the package. I think it would have really made a difference. I think another thing that would be really helpful is to teach better coping skills, not just to adult women, but to start in young women's doing that. Talk to young women about conflict resolution and managing change and dealing with disappointment and grief and loss. I think if we had a little bit more effective training in this area, it would go a long way in helping us behave a little better toward each other. And my last point is, I think we all need to learn to be more secure within ourselves. You know, yes, these friendships with other women sustain us and allow us to grow. But we also need to create a wellspring within ourselves that can replenish us in difficult times, not just rely on only other women friends to validate and sustain us in the things that we do. So that said, I will give the podium over to Julie to talk a little bit more specifically about her article and the points that she brought up, and I'd like to thank her for bringing up the subject for us to digest and talk more about.
I loved listening to what you had to say about single women versus married women. I remember being competitive too with single women before I got married, because it's a competition, you know, to get men. And then I thought, okay, all that's behind me once I got married. Well, the competition was still there, only this time it wasn't about men. It was just about other aspects of competition in women's relationships and envy. And I'd had enough of these experiences and had been hurt enough by it that it was cathartic to be able to write about this. And I appreciate being able to lend my voice to this. I'm a fan of I Love Lucy. I used to watch that show. I still do. I've seen those reruns 1,000 times. I've always been fascinated by Ethel and Lucy's friendship. Lucy's the prettier one. You know, she and Ethel really are the same age, really, in real life. But Lucy looks younger, she's thinner, she's prettier, she's got the handsome husband, she's got the baby. Ethel's got Fred. But yet, you know, But they also manage the building. I guess that's what she's got one up on Lucy. But their friendship is stable, and they love each other, and despite the conflicts. And I thought, you know, as I got older, I thought there's no such thing as that kind of friendship. You know, Ethel must be getting tired sooner or later of playing the second banana to Lucy. But now, in a realistic modern term, I look at Oprah and her best friend, Gayle King. Gayle King is certainly successful, but it's on Oprah's coattails. But Oprah even said one time in a show, she said, if the situations were reversed and Gayle had my kind of success, she goes, I don't know that I could be as supportive. And I appreciated that comment, but I really do think that that's kind of, Oprah and Gayle is kind of the Lucy and Ethel. And so I guess it is possible to have that kind of a friendship. I've never been able to have that kind of interaction with any of my friends without, well, I take that back. I have as long as we've been able to work through it. But let me talk a little bit about the notion of envy and competition. Envy is based on wanting what another person has. Usually those two, jealousy and envy, those terms are used interchangeably, but they're really different. Jealousy involves being afraid of losing what you already have, like let's say a boyfriend. Envy is based on wanting what another has. And, you know, really envy is admiration gone sour. And that's why the same things that attract you initially to your friend, if envy starts to come into play, those same things that that attracted you, you can easily start resenting your friend for those very things that attracted you to begin with, or vice versa. And there's varying degrees of envy. You know, there's a continuum. There's the admiration that you're so beautiful to the point of, well, now I kind of resent you for it, and then now I hate you for it. Now I want to destroy you and what you have. So there are varying degrees of envy, and it's that lethal kind of poisonous envy that kills friendships, because that's what's so sad is you end up hating the very thing that originally you loved. There are varying masks of envy too. That's the thing about envy is that it's so hard to admit to it, because when you admit to a friend that you're envious of her or she's envious of you, it's very difficult, because what you're saying is, I'm not as good as you, or I don't feel like I'm as good as you, or I don't feel as worthy of you as you are. And so instead of admitting those feelings to our friend, oftentimes then instead we'll gossip about her, we'll slander her. Well, have you ever had somebody make hostile jokes to you and say, oh, I was just teasing, when it was really a put down is what it was. We see rivalry, our friend might play the martyr, or maybe we do avoiding or withdrawing our friendship. I've seen that happen over and over with women. They start to withdraw. Like if you've gotten, like with me, when my husband was called to be the bishop, my friend of 4 years, who is my next door neighbor, the day he was sustained, she stopped speaking to me. And she was never going to come out and say, well, Julie, I really resent the power that comes with an attention you get because your husband's the bishop. She's not going to admit to that, and I didn't expect her to. But that is the problem with envy, is that it is so hard to admit to, because there's humiliation associated with that feeling. And I knew that even though my friend was suffering because it was hard for her to see this attention I was getting, that it wasn't like we ran for office, it's not like we wanted it, it happened to us. She still blamed me, refused to speak to me, she became increasingly hostile. When I tried to talk to her about it, she denied that there was a problem. So we see all these different masks of envy, that's what makes it so difficult, is because envy hides in the dark. Because of this denial, it just continues to fester. Let me say too, really quickly, about competition. I don't want to give you the impression that I think there's anything really innately wrong with competition and envy. I mean, these are human experiences that we all feel, and every friendship is prone to competition and envy. But what it really is all about is all of us want to be liked and admired, and there's nothing wrong with that. But the problem is in wanting to be admired and recognized, a lot of times we go then through these attention-seeking behaviors that derail our relationships with other women. We all want to feel recognized. We all want to feel validated by each other. And I think other women's opinions of us are important. I care more about what women think of me than men. And I think a lot of women feel that way. So yes, I want to feel validated. I want to feel accepted by other women. But if we start engaging in these competitive behaviors that are not appropriate, then that's when it can really evolve into something, into hostility, into gossip, into slander. And that's where the problem comes. We want to be connected to women. We need women. There was a time where when I had lost about three friendships due to envy that I swore women off. I thought, I'm not going to be friends with women anymore. This is just too hard. But after about 5 years, I decided I needed them. I needed women. I needed them in my life. And so this is just because we have this need for connection and this need for validation from each other, then inevitably conflict will enter any kind of intimate relationship, and usually its roots are tied in envy and competition. So this irony of needing each other, but at the same time wanting to separate ourselves and be individuals, have our individual autonomy, this tension is what brings us into this period, this like with Jana, what she was talking about, her friend, this tension in the relationship is this feeling of being left behind. Her friend was feeling like, because she wasn't getting married and her friend was moving away, she was feeling left behind. And so she wanted to reach out and try to bring her friend back to her comfortable place, back to her feeling of equality, being on the same playing field. And so that's where women's friendships, this differentiation, really brings in tension into the relationship. And again, a lot of it is based on envy. So just to recap, there's a lot of times where, like being the bishop's wife or having your husband be bishop, or I lost a friend when I graduated with my master's degree. I mean, it wasn't like she didn't have a master's degree. She had one too. But the fact that now, that was one thing she always had on me. She had a master's and I didn't. But now the playing field again was being leveled because now I was on her level and she felt threatened by that. And so it's not that we actually want the church calling or the degree that our friend has or maybe even her job where she's working 80 hours a week, but what we want is the perceived status, the recognition, the attention, and value that seems to be what this person has and enjoys. And that's where there's nothing, again, wrong with wanting to be validated and wanting people to recognize us as individuals. It's just that when we try to bring the other person down in order to assuage our own feelings is when it becomes very dangerous and hurtful. And I'll turn the time now over to Sonia.
This is kind of a nice experience for me to be on the speaker circuit with Julie, because Julie and I were two LDS women who got our master's degrees together at San Jose State, and Julie was one of the few people in our ward who validated me. And perhaps from the hard experience that you had, that you had learned to validate other people, and it certainly made my life a lot more rich and wonderful during those years. We used to walk down the hall together on the nights we had this classes the same, and another professor who had also gone to BYU just by coincidence said, "Here comes the Mormon battalion." So I thought it was, I thought you should know that for the first time ever in Sunstone, the Mormon battalion is here. Julie's paper appearing in Sunstone dealt with jealousy and the things that Mormon women would say to each other in a Mormon context, and so I've approached it from a Mormon context myself. And I'd like to begin, let's see, where are my notes? There we are, okay. And I want to say I've never really thought of relationships in terms of jealousy or envy in the way that Julie has, and so her article opened up for me a whole new way of thinking of things. My experience has been that when I've lost friends, it's because I was annoying. And Julie and they would say so. So I mean, it's not like I didn't have evidence. But Julie has suggested, when I've talked to her about various relationships that I've had with women, she suggested other ways of looking at it. And it's always pleasant to think that you might be less annoying than you actually are. So I do give a hearty thanks to Julie for opening up that whole area of discourse. But what was fascinating to me about the article was not so much the exploration of my own experiences, but the insight it offered in regards to how LDS women talk about each other. In a way, it offers many examples of what LDS women say about each other, and it also is an example of an LDS woman speaking about other LDS women. And it isn't the first time that's happened. In this book, Eye to Eye, Heart to Heart by Elaine Jack, which was published in 1993, Elaine Jack also devoted a chapter to the topic from which I'm going to read, because I know my letters. I also know my numbers. Okay, and the chapter, I'm not going to read the whole thing, it's okay. The chapter starts, "Once upon a time in a ward you know, a visitor attended on an average Sunday. It was a happy, pleasant ward with great diversity. Children, youth, and adults of many ages sat together in sacrament meeting. The building seemed well kept, the leaders well organized, the lessons well taught. The visitor thought, what lucky people must live in this ward. What a warm, inviting place this must be. They must truly love each other. She decided to come again, not to look but to listen to what these people said about their relationships. This is what she heard the next Sunday. One Relief Society counsel said to the other, I've decided our singles bring their problems on themselves. We reach out to them, but they don't respond. Sometimes I wish we didn't have so many in our ward. One young adult asked another, don't you just hate Relief Society? It's always so boring. The women are all old, and they only talk about married women's stuff. A grandmother said to her friend, I hear they're reorganizing the primary. I hope they don't call us. We've raised our families. It's the young mother's turn to work in primary. The Relief Society president said to the bishop, we work so hard and the sisters just don't appreciate it. They don't seem interested. They don't even seem to care. I don't feel the sisterhood in Relief Society I used to feel. And later, see Sister Jack, our single women are a real problem for us. What I noticed immediately, Sister Jack says, was the labeling of all single women as a problem. I feel our singles bring many of their problems on themselves, and so on. So it's not the first time that someone has at least tried to address the issue of what I call criticism of the sisters. It's interesting to contrast criticism of the brethren with criticism of the sisters, because there's very, very strict restrictions on what we are permitted to say in terms of the brethren. Criticism of the brethren is forbidden, even if it's right. But of course, criticism of the sisters isn't right, even if it's factually incorrect. And that's troubling, because it doesn't do anything for us. What I've noticed in examining LDS rhetoric as a whole is that criticism of the sisters is a consistent, I think, part of LDS conference rhetoric. The most recent example I can think of is the 2005 conference talk by Dallin Oaks, in which he referred to women pejoratively as confused about an issue that he frankly admitted had never properly been explained in the past. In 1993, in the Parable of the Keys, Elder Packer referred to women who complained about their subordinate position in the church as selfish and jealous participants in a petty dispute. And I recall many negative images that pop up in general authority discourse, all of them appearing in issues of power, when the issue was women had complained or challenged the status quo in terms of the power of males over women in the church, then this type of discourse arose. Let's see. Mm-hmm. And the difficulty is that there's nothing that women can do about it but treat each other better. And in fact, there's no reward for treating you better. There's severe punishment for treating general authorities as if they can be criticized. But if you criticize one of the sisters, there is no penalty. And one of the wonderful aspects of Julie's paper was that it calls for repentance. It asks us to repent of this kind of speech. And my belief is that unless there's a penalty for addressing sisters in this way, there's very likely not to be repentance. And so I'm calling for a penalty of sorts. We should have stocks in Relief Society or something and make people be in them if they speak ill of the sisters. It troubles me that LDS rhetoric has a pattern of criticism of women that's repeatedly addressed in authoritative LDS discourse that models for LDS women ways of discussing how LDS women can be judged. A lot of what was said about Julie in her ward was really because she diverged from the norm in her behavior. She got a master's degree. She missed one of her son's games. And this was considered a cause of concern. And so every time a woman sort of moves out of the proper role, she's fair game for criticism. And as long as there's no penalty for that, criticism of the sisters will continue. And I don't know what to do about it.
Obviously, Sonia's thought a lot about this and tried to apply her supposed intellectual skills to resolving this problem. But bless her heart, she hasn't been able to do it. And that Becky Lindford, bless her heart, she's been on this diet for about 47 years. And she just can't get rid of that cellulite. Bless her heart. That's one way that we in the Mormon women community get away with murder. We can say anything we want to about anybody as long as bless your heart is in there. Try it at your ward on Sunday. See how much fun it is. Why does anybody really compete? I think all of us, like Julie said and Sonia said, all of us want to belong, and we also want to be admired, and we want to be looked up to. Some of us are really psychotically, neurotically insecure. And I see insecurity as the basis for most of the competition among Mormon women. That's been my experience anyway. Most of us are just trying to find at least one little place where we can feel comfortable and safe, one little place that we're actually good at something. And if somebody else comes close to us and is equally good or better, oh, it can be destructive. It can be devastating. In fact, the best thing is to learn how to compete just with yourself, although that can be a nightmare as well. You want to be the best, at least in one thing. And this starts at a very early age in church. Primary, you wouldn't think that three-year-olds would care, but they do. They care about,
I want to bring my testimony, and I know my mom and dad love me.
Okay, you've seen it. This makes my skin crawl whenever a poor little thing gets up there to bear its testimony and, you know, talks about,
my dog Sparky was stuck to another dog, and I prayed, and Heavenly Father unstuck him.
I mean, it's sort of performance art up there, karaoke Sunday. These little darlings are competing with each other. And I used to have a mom that would try to blackmail me to bear my testimony by bringing a Snickers bar. I'm not making this up. So we're sitting there, and all of the other deacons and beehives are up there professing their testimony of the church, and she'd just open her bag. Please, go bear your testimony. Snickers. I never gave in. Thank you! So it does start early. In primary, it's also, who can memorize the Articles of Faith first? Who can win the attendance award? Who knows how to read the scriptures the best in front of everybody else? Who says the best prayers? Who knows the songs best? And that achievement day, who knows how to do those crafts better than anybody else? Painting, sewing, knitting, crocheting, or the ever odious scrapbooking. Oh my goodness, but more on that later. Then we move into young women, and of course, that's where the real competition begins, because you start judging yourself and everybody else according to looks, according to weight, their hair, their clothes, their intelligence in some cases, not all, but not hardly any, but it's all the superficial junk that our girls are stuck together with trying to make your own way. It is such an awful time at 12 and 13, because there's a few of them that are just, you know, get boobs and they have beautiful hair and are thin and they get their periods and the boys are all after them. And then there's the trolls like I was. And I had to live up to, you know, Barbie Skipper. I guess it's Skipper that's the teenager, Barbie's little sister. Young women stand for truth and righteousness. And, you know, the beehives model what they see the Laurels and the Maya maids doing. And especially, who can say the motto the best? And who can do it backwards? And who can do it in Greek? And who can really learn to use that affected language? And see, Laurel's doing this crap. I mean, it's very stuff, behaviors. It's very disheartening when you're surrounded by these gorgeous, talented, intelligent girls who kind of slip into this whiny, sing-songy, and I know the church is true, and I'm so grateful for my parents. Like, they're so spiritual. I just want to be like my mom. And they start pounding girls with this, you got to get married. Your only value is in how soon you're married and if he's a return missionary. Now, my daughter is 13 years old, and I am proud to say that she has a really big mouth. And she has no fears, no qualms at all about speaking up in beehives. And she said that if she got married, she wanted to get married at Disney World and then go to some temple afterwards. Well, this brought the wrath of the bishopric down on me. And I think it's great. Mickey Mouse giving, you know, doing your marriage ceremony, that's hot. So the bishop was a little upset with me, but I don't care. What are they going to do, excommunicate me? Bring it on, baby. Clothes. So there's these two things. It's the physical and the spiritual. And you really are looking at seeing it. You know, there's always the one really uber spiritual girl, and she's usually a little homely. And she knows how to do everything crafty. And then there's usually one psychotic child. That was me. And then there's the rest of us that are just trying to navigate this as best we can and stay alive. Then some of us go on to college after Young Women, and that's when it gets vicious. I mean, the gloves are off. We're now all officially on the meat market. We're looking for a return missionary who happens to be looking for Misha Barton Hinckley. So they want the body of Misha Barton and the spirituality of a Hinckley. So you have to become what these return missionaries want. Intelligence isn't necessary. In fact, sometimes it's not a good thing for a marriage. But if you're smart, that's okay. You can teach your children engineering and physics in the home. Then that return missionary is looking for traditional values, right? Support the priesthood. And this is also big for wanting, you want to be engaged at least when you're in college. Oh, because then you can exhale, then you can breathe freely. You know your calling and election is made sure. You're stuck with this eternal companion, the priesthood provider for the rest of eternity, so you can finally move forward. Now, for those of us who were not pretty, I was not the Cache Valley Dairy princess. Go figure. Some of us had to go and get an education because we weren't sure we were ever going to get married, and we had to support ourselves. Scary. Some of us went on missions as well. And the mission is a strange place because you don't compete with the elders because you can't do anything. You can't baptize anyone. You can't confirm anyone. You can't, you know, aspire to being a district leader or a zone leader or an assistant. But you are stuck there with this other person 24/7. And between the two of you, one of you is always going to be prettier. One of you is always going to be smarter. One of you is going to be more spiritual. One of you is going to be more talented with the language or with the discussions. There's constant comparison going on. When you get home, if you're fortunate, you stay single. And if you are dutiful, you get married. And you're really desperate to get married after a mission. I mean, ew, you know, old woman here. If you find a nice man who will marry you, you are in the newlywed sector. Now, this is just from my experience when I was a newlywed, but it was scary because it was back to different ways of looking at your looks, how fertile you are, how soon you're going to start bearing your children, going to Mother's Day out or mother picnics. Bring all of your kids. If you don't have kids, then you'll feel uncomfortable. And always crafts and scrapbooking. Birth control was a big deal. When I was a newlywed, I was the young women's president in my sort of white trash ward back in Virginia, and all of us in Young Women were on the pill. So when it came time for Mother's Day, you know how they give you those obnoxious carnations on the end of a yardstick and say, thank you for mothering, thank you for being a devout mother? So I asked the bishop why he didn't have all of those on the pill and were delaying motherhood to please stand up and get their carnation on a yardstick as well, but that was not well received either. Then we get to, oh, and fertility is huge. Not only if you can't have kids, people start thinking, ooh, is it something they did when they were younger? Is the Lord not happy with them? Or is it a matter of physiology, biology? And it's a horrible thing because you usually end up turning on yourself. You know, why am I cursed with no fertility? It's a horrible thing. Then you move into the midlyweds, And we start competing over our callings. Why did she get to be primary president? Why did she get to be the Relief Society president? We also start forming our own little cliques. Now, usually you form cliques among the women with whom you serve in an auxiliary. And that can be kind of hurtful because it only includes those women who are in that auxiliary. And if you're not in that, you're kind of left alone, forgotten. Other cliques include book groups, dinner groups, sort of what, like Mary Ellen was talking about, these very low-key, you know, let's invite only the right people kind of things. I hate that, but it goes on everywhere. Everywhere I've lived, there's these little clicky things, and if you are in the elite, then you get to belong. But if you're not elite, you do not get to belong. Ooh, and another really odious area of competition is in your husband's callings. Ew! Or in your father's calling, or in your grandfather's calling. And the reason I bring that up is my bishop back in Virginia most recently was the son of President James E. Faust of the First Presidency of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And he took every frickin' opportunity, every single time he was at the podium, to remind us all of the fact that he was the son of President James E. Faust, my father. Now, I love this guy. He is great when he isn't dropping names. But I think he's competitive about it because he's insecure. You know, we're all just looking for a way to feel good about ourselves and to feel proud of ourselves. Find a place for us. Ew, and another experience that happened was competition between mission presidents' wives. It goes on, and it's nasty. I mean, the gloves are off. A lot of them, they were in a mission president's conference in Italy. And my friends were the mission presidents at the time, and they had all of the mission presidents in Europe meet in Rome. And they had Henry Eyring come and speak to them, and my friend, who was not from the Wasatch Front, told me just the most despicable stories about how, you know, the wives were all a flutter and a twitter about finding, oh, so-and-so's from the holiday, you know, whatever, 700 ward, and she's from, oh, the Brighton whatever ward, and they stuck together. Now, what does your husband do? What is his calling? You know, is there a possibility for advancement in the 70 or maybe in the 12? And it's nasty. If you're not part of that group, it's nasty. It's lethal. One last area is mothers or women who compete through their children. And this is, oh, you know, the child is a direct reflection of the mother. If your mother's doing her job, then little Billy or whoever is going to be showing up and bearing testimony in front of everybody and living vicariously through their kids. I had a mom like that, obviously, who tried to bribe me with Snickers. And a lot of that goes on. So I think when we realize that we're all just in the same boat and that Heavenly Father actually loves everyone else as much as he loves me, and that he does love me, and he does love all of these women, and we're all just on the same boat. I was like Julie in that I was always one of the guys in school. I just got along so much better with guys. But I need women. I need loving women around me. There's nurturing and similarities in thought and background, and they're just, women are wonderful. We need to love each other. And I say this in the name of Jesus Christ, amen.
This is just so incredibly fun. This is my first time doing a Salt Lake Symposium for Sunstone. And yesterday I spoke on a panel where I was the only woman. And let me tell you, they did not have nearly as much fun as I'm experiencing it here today. There's no doubt that when Mary Ellen called me to comment on Julie's article, which I had read, and I so admired her courage to put into print, to struggle to find language about what is so much a part of Mormon women culture and also larger culture. But I know Mary Ellen was saying, we need a therapist. We're supposed to have somebody in that field to come talk about this. And so that was my ticket into all of this. But there's no way that my words or my thoughts come from just that experience. Because I'm also a woman who has grown up in the Mormon church and has had that roller coaster of Mormon culture, of where you're in, when you're out, when you are really trying to not throw up on the ride to get back up on top, and continuing to think someday I will land and get off into the wonderful land of complete acceptance and acceptability. And I think I've tried that in many ways throughout my life, and it has taught me a great deal. You know, but first and foremost, there's the other side of all of this. I so appreciate Becky's humor. I mean, humor is wonderful in bringing us to being able to talk about topics that are hard. Because of my work and my friendships, I also know there are times competition and envy is painful. It's excluding. It causes us to doubt, where do we belong, where do we fit? And sometimes causes us to go looking in other territories. Is there more acceptance in other places? I also appreciate the few men that are here. I wondered how many men would come to this workshop, because men are also affected by competition. Your world succeeds on how well you can compete. And that's something that we will never get away from. But all the more reason why in our Mormon community, amongst our Mormon ward, there should be the one place where we have freedom from it, let alone the place where we have to negotiate it the most. So in trying to think about all of this, there is no way I could do it without also thinking about my life. And I remember, whether it was insecurities or not, thinking that being a good Mormon woman meant I would belong. Now, I didn't come from a family that belonged, but I wanted to belong. And so I remember envying the other side of all those who seemed to fit. I don't know if any of you have gone through that. I mean, I really looked. I can remember being a young married woman. I remember there was a woman in my ward. She was so Molly. Oh, she was everything. I mean, she just knew how to dress, how to act, how to interact. She had all the friendships. And I remember going and buying clothes. I don't know if any of you have ever done that. I mean, I'm embarrassed to admit it. But I remember buying this blue dress, and it had white polka dots. Now, if anybody who knows me knows, I would just be like, can't even fathom that. But it was like, will I fit? Will I find acceptance? Will I be able to say, I belong here, I have a calling, I will have friendships, because this is where I want to be. This is my heritage. This is my faith. This is where I should find community. Of course, that didn't last very long. I think I could wear that dress for all of 5 minutes, put color on me, and I just about panic. But it taught me an interesting lesson. But I didn't learn right away. I mean, there was a part when I was called to be a Relief Society president. I was very young. And very young in an older ward. And feeling that enormous pressure of what can I say and not say to continue to not rock the boat of competition. Who can I be? Who can't I be? And I can remember thinking, I have to look a certain way, be a certain way, talk a certain way. And there was that envy and comparison of thinking that would give me acceptance. I will finally have a place where my soul is at comfort. It was a hard lesson to learn that is just a roller coaster ride that costs you the very essence of your own being. I thought I'd done pretty well until I decided to go back to graduate school. Now, I had been involved in the field of social work and doing all kinds of things before that. Kind of kept that quiet because that made me a little too different. Because we love to say we promote differences, but if it's too different, we do tend to exclude. And so there was a part of me always negotiating where I could be a little different, but not too different. And when I went back to graduate school, there was great skepticism, very similar to the comments that have been shared here. Mostly because I knew I was greatly respected and admired, but I was also very much excluded as one of them. It was very interesting, after I was done with graduate school and was starting a lot of my other work, I went through a divorce. And it was amazing how that created, that's why she's getting a divorce. She abandoned her family, she went to graduate school. Look what is happening in her life. And yet, in private, a few would say, aren't you grateful that you felt impressed to follow that, to do that? You now have a way to provide for your sons, for the life ahead. But it couldn't be publicly acknowledged. It could privately. And I often went and thought, because it's too different. We try so hard to keep a norm of comfortability, as opposed to appreciating that the gospel should be a place of stretching for the multiplicity of our ideas. So on this roller coaster ride, I went through being really in, working hard to be in the group, then watched that ride where I misjudged and end up really out of the group. And it's funny when you're out, how everything gets affected. Your callings change, your friendships change. Your children are affected in my case, they were. And yet you still struggle with, but this is where I belong, or is it? Is this where I will find acceptance and fitting in? And watching other people say they're so excited for you or proud of you, but not including you in many ways, whether it be the parties, whether it be the showers, or the social structure that goes on in a ward, or how much a ward doesn't know what to do with a single member, which we could have a whole nother conversation about that. The most fascinating thing, though, was when I got remarried. And I got, without wanting it, back on the roller coaster ride into acceptability, which I found fascinating because I was no longer interested in that kind of belonging. I was more interested in making sense of all the pieces of differences and the differences of other people that crossed my path. But as my husband came back, came into my ward, it was amazing how he had the status of certain callings, and that then the competition changed or the comparison changed to that now I'm the gospel doctrine teacher. I doubt that that would have ever have happened when I was single. Now, of course, the irony about this whole experience is all of this happened in the same ward. So I have lived in the same ward for 30 years of being in and out and in and out and riding that ride. Do I know that people's intents were never to exclude? Do I really think their intent was never to be cruel or mean or harmful? But we don't know what to do with differences. And yet, to me, the gospel is all about how do we embrace the unique paths and the sharings of talents, ideas, different pathways, learning from each other. I would be incredibly bored. And I was when I tried to be more like everyone else. But the price you pay is very difficult. I think the hardest is to say, even if the price is hard, where do I belong? How do I hold on to the baby and, don't throw out the baby with the bathwater? How do I hold on to the things I value? How do I speak about the things that are important to me? What forms do I trust doing that in? Where can I speak out about where people have hurt me or where there's comparison? We will never get away from comparison. I live in Orange County, California. I understand it is the place where more plastic surgery is done than any place in the world. And that is quite an experience of people striving for the evaluation and the comparison of appearance that affects women and men, and affects women in how they see men and men in how they want to be seen to other men, more importantly than even other women. It's a fascinating world that I've been thrown into in my work. And yet it still breeds, where do I fit? Where do I belong? I think we will do almost anything to avoid judgment. That's another word that I think really stands up here with envy, with competition, with comparison, is the enormous pain and fear of not wanting to be judged. And so I guess my question to all of us as we're thinking about why we are in this workshop, or why we found Julie's article interesting and picked it up and read it, is at what point do we say, I'm willing to forsake parts of myself because I will do anything to avoid that judgment. That judgment is so isolating. That judgment can be so painful. And yet anybody who's been down that road or on that roller coaster, I tend to have those conversations with them that this is much more, though, costly in the long run, that you feel like you've lost a piece of yourself. You've lost a piece of what you thought was divine in you. You've lost a piece of connection to what may have been ahead, and you find yourself very stuck and then very vulnerable to a whole slew of other things that cause despair and discouragement. So for me, all I can tell you is that it's been a ride of saying, okay, I hate judgment. I will get as scared as anybody else to think I will be judged for how I talk, what I say. But I also know that I will speak about the things that are important to me, but also appreciate that if they're too different, my words don't go anywhere. It's a constant negotiation of how do I keep stretching anybody who crosses my path, whether it be in church, in an educational setting, in people I talk to, or whomever I run into, or sitting on a panel, that my words can be challenging, stretching, but not so different that it creates isolation. Because above all else, I value community. Even though the majority of my life has been in isolation, it doesn't change. I want connectedness. I want those friendships. And like the women here today have talked about, you keep coming back to it because there's something of value. It's our challenge to try and find a way to know that envy, jealousy, comparison, competition are part of the larger dominant discourse. Do we need to traffic in it? I hope not. But do we have to be aware that it is there? Yes. And I think that's our challenge, to hold on to our souls and to find the communities that we all desire.
We have about 20 minutes or so for a question and answer from the audience. If you have anything you want to direct at a specific panelist, we've got the microphone in the middle of the room, so you don't have to come all the way up to the front. But please, if you have a question, direct it into the microphone so we can get it on the tape. Thanks.
So I don't really know who I'm directing this to, whoever feels it, but this is a topic I've pretty much, I guess, chosen to ignore at some level. But I know subconsciously I've just learned to tone myself down or choose what I say to certain women if you want to be at all part of the group. But, you know, this last year it really hit me through three examples. I've never had a real close relationship with my mother, but it seems like it's gotten worse. And I was trying to figure out why. And I was talking to my sister, and she said, she's jealous of you. I said, you've got to be kidding me. She's my mother. There's nothing I would want more than if my daughter surpassed me in every way. I would just feel so excited for her. And that thought just seems so... Where would that thought come from? How is that possible that a mother wouldn't want everything for that daughter? And that really freaked me out. And then I realized a similar thing was happening with my mother-in-law. She had chosen to raise 11 kids, but had given up other choices. And I guess she had seen me as someone who somehow was keeping my feet in both camps and resented me for that. And I just thought, again, what is this? I noticed no one spoke to that relationship, but that's been most troubling to me. And then just a woman in my ward, it really hit home. She's my age, but again, didn't really know her, and then suddenly I was getting a lot of hostility from her. I said, what is going on? And we had a friend in common, and just saying, you know, basically, jealous me for what? You know, what did I do to deserve this? And I think it's just horrible. I personally love to hang around people I consider my superiors. If I was Oprah's friend, I'd be thrilled, because to me it'd be a great resource. I wouldn't necessarily want to work my whole life as her, you know, her right-wing woman, but I would love to be connected to her, as I love to be connected to any powerful, confident, intelligent person. But basically, I just wonder what your thoughts were about that mother-daughter dynamic, specifically.
I'll answer that part of that real quickly. You know, I do bring that up in the article, and I wanted to write more about it, but the editor said, that's another topic for another day. But it is frightening to have your own mother, you know, envy you because she's supposed to love you. But there's a whole chapter. I've read books on mother-daughter envy, and it is quite common. What's interesting, as much as I love my mother, when my article came out, she started writing. And she has a flair for writing, and she sent an article into the Ensign, and darn, didn't get published. But I thought, isn't that interesting that it wasn't until I got her own daughter got published that she started trying to, and I'm not saying she's competing with me, but there is that undercurrent. I know it. I know it's there. It's very painful. Yeah, yeah. And I think part of it, it's complicated, but part of it is women in our generation have more opportunities than our mothers had. And it used to be that we envied each other's, traditionally, each other's beauty, wealth, you know, which, whether it be your own wealth or usually it was your husband's, and your children, you know, your family. But now, because there's so many more choices afforded to women than like in your mother-in-law's generation, perhaps, and plus, you know, it's more socially acceptable in the church than it was 30 years ago to get an education and to pursue these other venues, that because there's more choices available, then there's more difference. So when you compare, you find difference feels threatening. So actually, I think your mother-in-law and your mom, probably they admire you, but they resent you at the same time. And that's where those two feelings are so conflicting. My mother, I think, feels the same way. She wants me to be successful. Part of her really enjoys it that I'm successful, but I just am not supposed to be more successful than she is. And I know she would never think that she thinks that way, but that's still the gut, the knee-jerk reaction.
But that's why it's so troubling to me to know how to address it. They don't even want to admit that it's there.
That's where the denial.
So where do you even go with that?
That's where I question with this whole article is, yeah. It's unless you admit there's a problem and say, okay, yeah, I have these feelings, then we can't talk about it. We can't get past it because the denial is so strong.
And I think it's really hard because if they're feeding you all this resentment, how do you deal with that? Because I would feel like I was patronized them if I treated them better,
yes,
than they were treating me, and then I wouldn't respect,
yeah,
them.
Yeah, and then if you're really nice, they resent you for that because they, yeah.
Yeah. That too.
It is a no-win snare. And so that's why you have to have a strong sense of self to pursue your own goals and to be willing to be criticized. And that's what I found. I'm going to be criticized, but I don't care anymore. It's just like what Anne was saying. That this is, I'm going to pursue my own path. I'm the captain of my own ship, and I define who I am. My mother doesn't define who I am. Nobody else defines who I am but me.
And I can tolerate that pretty well, but I hate sacrificing the intimacy. You know, and I was saying to David, we're staying with his mother, and Lana said, she's not even looking at me. Well, yeah, it's just that these are relationships you can't just leave behind very easily. You're constantly dealing with that.
But don't sacrifice yourself for their feelings.
I want to address that issue, but from the other person's point of view. One of the women that you mentioned was somebody who had chosen to be a mother, a full-time mother, and had a lot of children. And one of the reasons that she made that choice and thought it was a wonderful choice was because that kind of choice is hyped all the time. And women are constantly told that there are incredible rewards to that kind of choice. And of course there are. But of course, when you've made all of that choice, you know the hard parts of that choice too. Having 11 children is an extremely difficult job and a huge burden. It also, with the joy, brings an awful lot of sorrow, and some of your children will have failures that will be like a knife in your heart. That's what my mother always used to say to me. It's like a knife in my heart that you've done this. And so I say it to my children, and then they laugh. And they know not to take me seriously because I explained that to them, and they don't take anything I say seriously. They took that too far. But my point is, it must be like a knife in your heart to be in Relief Society and to have sat there for years doing exactly what you were told to do, and then to have someone else be able to do that and do some other wonderful things and have everything be fine for them. And your chance is gone. And that is a sting that if it had happened to me, I'm sure it would have hurt so badly. My question is, how can we reach out to those women when we sense that that might be the issue and make them have that same sense of how wonderful they are? The bottom line is, if you devote your life to your children, you will get very little economic security from it, unless every one of them says, oh, come and live with me, Mom. Yeah, and that's the point. I raised four children at home and did that for 25 years, and then went into the job market at the very lowest possible wages, no job equity, no respect. You know, I was the Rodney Dangerfield of all the teachers out there. And I resented that this is what I was getting for the 25 years of nose wiping and screaming at kids for sticking their fingers in light sockets and saving them and teaching them moral values. I got to be a person who was working at low wages. So it wasn't as if I was jealous of someone, but if someone is in that position where they've made huge sacrifices and get nothing for it after being told they would get everything, that is really annoying. So I'd like to see you, Julie, write another article from that perspective.
I'll try. I've been in therapy forever on this issue because I have a wacko mother. And my therapist knows a lot about her, and finally he just said, you know, you got to cut your losses. You got to know your boundaries. You have to establish boundaries. And don't let her invade your boundaries. I mean, you are an adult, you're a human being, you're a grown-up, and she's not going to change. Now, this is when she was, you know, in her mid-70s, and it would just upset her. So in my particular case, it was find someone else to be your mom, or to find several or people to provide mothering for you and the things that you need. So that's what I would do.
Becky, the bless your heart rule is true. I bear testimony of that. But also, you may not be aware of the cross-stitch corollary, which is that nothing is offensive if it is done in counted cross-stitch. So when we're at lunch, maybe Mary Ellen can tell you about the cross-stitch that I made for her. And I'm wondering where you're going to hang it in your new house, Marielle. But, you know, I just had this conversation with my brother, my younger brother, and my youngest sister last night, and they said to me, you know, I just don't get your relationship with one of our other sisters, who's the next sister after me in age. And she goes, I just don't get your relationship. You say such mean things to each other all the time, and you say bad things about each other's children. And they said, but their take on it was that my sister is jealous of me and that she resents me, and she is insecure, which we've always known because she's the queen of one-upmanship. But that this is how it's taking life, is through her criticism of me and trying to bring me down and criticizing my children, who are, I'm sorry, fabulous and brilliant. But talking to you, hearing you talk about this issue today, you know, I was thinking about this all night, last night. What am I going to do about my sister? And I think the only thing that I really can do is to just, like Becky said, establish my boundaries. And when she criticizes my kid, say something nice about one of hers, you know, and just put a stop to it, because it's just got to, and there's nothing I can do about the fact that I own a house. There's nothing I can do about the fact that my husband makes more money than her husband. There's nothing I can do about those things. But I can stop and just stop.
Becky told me I needed to make a comment. But I really do have an opinion here. And what I have found in all these relationships that we have with our mothers and our sisters and the women in our wards, wherever we have them, it doesn't matter who it is, I look for whatever it is that I admire in them. And I just don't care what they're thinking of me. It's all right if they don't like me, because I feel good about myself. that it does take time to come to that opinion of yourself. But the more you tell yourself that you're good, you're fine, that God is working in you to be who you are, it makes me feel powerful to see something good in somebody else and to tell them. And I tell people all the time, my good friends and my people that I know that distance themselves from me, if I'm talking to them, I tell them something I admire about them, because I do.
It's sincere. The effects and what you want, but I'm curious if any of you have an idea of the etiology, the why, the genesis of what's going on in our culture that this is so common.
That was covered in Margaret Toscano's presentation earlier.
Yeah, seriously.
You criticize who you can criticize, but you have to criticize somebody just because it's part of our nature. We don't get to criticize the brethren, but the sisters are fair game. You know who butters your bread in the church, and it's the general authorities. But the sisters are fair game. You can have a few friends, and then everyone else is someone that you can criticize without compunction.
You don't need a honey.
No, yeah. Exactly.
And you know, it's not just women. It's men. Yeah. Men compare too. So I don't mean to have us assume that it's just a woman thing. But society lets men compete more than we do women. Women, it's not considered ladylike, so we push those feelings underground, and we pretend we're all nicey-nice to each other when we're not really. Whereas men, they can be more openly competitive, and it's like, okay, they're just men being men. So, but it is a universal experience, and it's just the LDS culture has its own brand of envy. But, you know, I see envy universally, and I see it at San Jose State, you know, where I work and stuff, so...
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. And so that.
It's cultural and structural. I mean, it's built into the hierarchical structure of the church. If we don't have any say in making the rules of the church, if we don't even write our own manuals, it's a faulty foundation from the get-go. I mean, we're screwed to begin with. Sorry.
I have seen a lot of competition in LDS men too.
Because, you know, we're in a hierarchy. The church is a hierarchy. And just like any kind of business, you know, men will compete for slots because there is power and attention that goes with those callings. Yes, yes. And admiration and respect, which is universal again. And it doesn't matter your gender. So, I don't want to, I think I've seen men in the church compete too.
So what I'm hearing you suggest is that the competition exists in both genders, and there's really not that much difference between. And see, and from where I come from, as far as my perspective, I find it fascinating when I first discovered that women dressed for other women. They didn't dress for men because they knew that other women would be judging them because most men are oblivious to it.
Exactly.
So,
however, as a priesthood holder, I'm assuming, and a member of the church, you have an automatic structure, and there are hundreds of ways that you can feel good about yourself as a priesthood holder and an office holder. Not only do you have this power, but you have specific jobs that you're going to be doing, and you get tons of recognition in the form of advancement, and we don't have that.
Okay, so are you suggesting it's an LDS phenomenon?
No, that's just this particular brand of competition is what we're talking about.
And so getting back to the original, I'm just curious if any of you had any assumptions about the origins culturally, and I know that there's a lot of, I mean, like Toscano's talk before.
Well, recorded history that he
came and Abel, and he envied him to the point where, because God accepted Abel's offering and not Cain's, and Abel was favored by God, so he killed him. So, you know, it goes like way back. And we could even, I think, in my opinion, Jesus Christ was crucified because of envy. You know, they envied his power, his growing popularity. So it's like, and I even think in the pre-existence, you know, we hear about Lucifer, and it sounds like he was envious. Yeah, he was envious of Christ. He wanted his plan. So, you know, it's been around.
Yeah, I don't think it's limited to Mormon circles at all. But you will find it in any cultural subgroup where women's roles are limited. You will find this in spades. And I was thinking about the phenomenon of the temple Nazi. You all know who they are. I didn't come up with this term. A member of my Relief Society presidency came up with this term at a dinner party at my house. The temple Nazis, you know, the matrons who are always there to enforce the rules and tell you that you're being bad.
Yeah.
There's tons of them, and I think all of us have probably had an experience with them, you know, because they only have this limited amount of authority, and they are bound and determined to exercise it to the full extent.
Yes. Absolutely.
And everyone works like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they'll make up rules that they can enforce.
Yeah. There's more starring roles in the male universe. The female right. universe has far more starring roles.
So we do. We fight for those. Exactly. You said it.
There might not be the discourse of criticism of Mormon men in the authoritative discourse that there is about Mormon women, because there isn't really a need to reassure Mormon women that they do not have the priesthood, or that they must remain in their role, in the discourse directed at men. So I have a sense of that. I haven't done any serious research on it, but because of you, I'm going to look into it.
There's an important book that has been out a couple of years called Odd Girl Out. Maybe some of you are familiar with it. And Odd Girl Out. And it talks about, and I think it addresses the issue of why competition manifests itself differently in groups of men and in groups of women. And this book was a study done by a sociologist in which she interviewed extensively girls in the middle school ages. And basically it's the answer to the question, why do these kinds of envious, backstabbing, manipulative, gossiping, all of these sort of underhanded manifestations of envy and competition. It's about the different ways that girls and boys are socialized in power issues. And it's considered not feminine to be openly assertive. It's not feminine to have an opinion about something. One of the most interesting parts of the book was two pages of the researcher asked girls to say what were the most important values. And there were girl values and not girl values. And all of the competent leadership, intelligent, all of those kinds of values were not girl values. And the girl values were having to do with appearance and popularity and all of these kinds of things. And so what happens when you have this kind of socialization that you are not allowed to use power in certain ways, of course we want power. We use power. And so it goes underhanded, it becomes secret. And anyway, I think this is an interesting study for anyone to look at.
I have one last comment. I forgot to tell you about, I had a conversation with one of my mentors just last night. He and his wife neither of them are members of the church. They teach at Utah State University, and my main friend that Paula knows has taught history there for 25 years at least, and he has seen kids come and go, and I asked them if they noticed anything different or about their Mormon students and the girl students as opposed to non-member and male students. And one of the scariest things they said was that they think that the pressure to comply with the church regulations, if you will, is much more difficult today than it was when I was a student there 25 years ago. And also, he gives them each the assignment to write their autobiography, and these are freshman girls and freshman boys that are in the class. And he's found that with the Mormon freshman girls, almost all of them put down that they're going to marry a return missionary. They look at it as a journal writing exercise, and they give Sunday school manual responses in all of this, whereas it's supposed to be something very different than what he assigned. Also, their pain at witnessing so many girls who are desperate to get married so that they can have this feeling of acceptance by God and by the culture. And, you know, intelligent girls that give it all up because they're afraid they won't get married. So I thought that was very interesting to hear from a non-Mo.
All right, one more quick question.
Okay. When my husband and I were newly married, we moved into his home ward. And, yeah, I know. But, because we were living with his parents to save up money. And when we moved in, he was familiar with everybody, but I wasn't. And so I felt outcasted in the very beginning. And we lived there for about a year and a half. And yet still, for that year and a half, I was not accepted by anybody. And so every Sunday when I would come home, I would cry because I felt like I had to have a child to fit in. And then we moved to a ward that I loved. But then we had to move back to this old ward, and I hate it. Because now that I have a daughter, I still don't fit in. And I want to know how to cope with that. Because, you know, I only have my husband to tell, and he understands it. And, oh, I'm sorry. And he really hates the ward too. But we can't afford to move. You know? And so, like, what do? And I also feel the same. He's family because he has two sisters, and they compete constantly. But, you know, I see them, and I'm like, that's stupid. Why are you competing over this stupid stuff? You know, but I watch back and I'm like, you know, I don't want to compete against them because I don't feel like I need to. But at church, I feel a need that I need to. And, but like, I've recently, you know, like I need to step back and say, you know, I really don't want to be friends with these women. So why am I trying so hard to impress them?
Yeah.
You know, and yet there's one woman who is like me. And yet we kind of have a connection. And it's so sad, it's just us two in this huge ward. So I just want to know how to cope with it.
I've not been in those exact shoes, but I have had ones that pinch like that. And I would say no to this ward that is poisoning you. See if there's another ward in the area where the bishop would want to talk to you and be able to say, you know, while we're in this situation, until the situation changes and we can move somewhere else, can we come to your ward instead? This is the pain and the suffering that we're experiencing by being part of this ward and feeling rejected by being part of this ward. I would go elsewhere. Even if you don't get permission, I would go somewhere else rather than trying to bonk every Sunday, because that's going to just completely deplete you both. And you know, you've tried it and it hasn't worked, and you've tried harder and it hasn't worked, and the one of the things that you thought would help you fit better, you know, by having a child and maybe having some common ground with women, then that didn't work either. And I would just say, you know, it might be time to chart your own course if you're comfortable doing that.